I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Creature Feature, production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host of Mini Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today on the show, we are getting gooey and mucousy. We are talking about animal immune systems. Now, as we hopefully exit the cold and flu season, I'm sure a lot of you have had some recent experience with your immune system. And despite how unpleasant it is also really fascinating. So today is a special episode because I have a guest who is a naturalist, a teacher, and an author whose recent book, Sick, is about amazing stories of the animal immune system. It would be a book that if I had got my hands on this book when I was a kid, it would be like my personal Bible. It is really fun, even for adults. Welcome, Heather Montgomery.
Hey, I'm so excited to be here and talk to folks who are just as excited as I am to learn from the animal world. It's so amazing what's out there. If we open our eyes and start asking questions, wow, I just get carried away with it.
I feel like we're very much kindred spirits because I love the grossness of biology. Obviously, I do love a beautiful butterfly. I love a beautiful bird. But I think I also enjoy appreciating just the, you know, the poop of nature. It's so interesting. And it's, I mean, it's not only a great way to, I think, teach kids about it, because, like, you know, you got to lean in a little bit to like the gross stuff to get kids interested. But honestly, I also believe that is true of adults. Like, we may not like to admit it, but I certainly have never outgrown learning stuff about poop and finding it both kind of funny and really interesting.
Right. Isn't that funny that happens? Like, when we grow up, we're supposed to not be interested in the things that we're innately interested in. I'm not sure why, but it's like, we're always attracted and repelled at the same time by these things. And those are the things that fascinate me. I'm kind of curious as to why people are so interested in the icky stuff, but we are.
Yeah.
And it's really cool.
It is really interesting because it makes some sense that we are repelled by poop because, I mean, in some ways it's very practical, right? Poop can spread parasites. It can spread disease. But it's good that we're not, you know, that we grow out of the phase of playing in our own poop. However, it is still really interesting. I think that we are drawn to kind of like, you know, when you're on a hike and you see some animal dung and you see there's stuff poking out of it, I think people would be lying if like they wouldn't admit that that's a little interesting. And you're kind of like, okay, I do kind of want to poke that with a stick. And find out what's going on in there. It's both gross for good reason, but it's also really interesting.
Exactly. That's actually what led me to write a whole book about poop. A different book. You know, it was amazing.
Different book, yes.
But it was like the surprising science, right? That we, when we look at this stuff that's so gross, what we can actually learn about the world, whether it's animals, you know, or the rest of the world, all of the kind of big questions that come out of SCAT.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's a whole thing. Like in research, it's such an important actual kind of like research method is collecting and studying animal poop, which sounds, you know, it sounds like not a fun job. But then when you think about it, like that is kind of cool because you get to be out in nature, you collect a bunch of dung, and then you bring it back for analysis. But there is one poop story I want to talk about a little bit. It's in your book. It's, I think, one of the most endearingly gross stories about poop. It is about puppy poop and the mother's response to puppy poop. And it's really cute, but also horrifyingly disgusting. And it's one of those things where it's like perfectly combining cuteness with grossness.
Exactly, right? So if you're a mom and you've got a whole litter of puppies in a, you know, together, what are they going to do a lot of is poop, right? And yeah. That's awesome. You got to get rid of the stuff. Plus, what if there's parasites in it, which there likely are, you know, if you're not a pet and taken care of. And so how do you deal with that? Because the puppy's immune system can't deal with it at all. So mom sacrifices and she laps it up. She carries it away from her babies through her own digestive system, which is atrocious, but not really, because her immune system's better able to handle these kinds of parasites. Plus, she basically hauls away, and she can't pick it up with her hands, right? So she basically hauls it away
right
through her system and deposits it elsewhere. And if she deposits it elsewhere soon enough, the eggs haven't hatched for, say, the roundworm. And so she gets rid of them. It's just like that in and of itself, that kind of behavioral adaptation is phenomenal to me. Like how that came about. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Ooh, gross, but awesome too. You know?
It's so gross, but it's so sweet. Cause like, obviously, you know, it's this dog wanting to, I mean, it's hard to talk about animals in terms of what they want, like, because they have these instincts, right? And this mother dog doesn't know why she's drawn to eating her offspring's poop. But it's still sweet because it's like this instinct to protect your offspring, to help them grow and develop. I mean, it makes sense. That's how evolution works. But it's also like it's one of the things that, like, oh yeah, like humans are not the only ones that deal with baby poop. Like other animals deal with baby poop. A cute thing, I think, another kind of cute, gross poop thing is that birds, a lot of bird species, they don't want to just have their baby birds poop and have the poop accumulate in the nests. So the baby bird poop is actually kind of comes in, when it comes out, it's sort of encased in this like mucosal sac, and then it lifts its little butt up and presents this poop to its mom, and the mom bird just like picks it up with her beak because, you know, she doesn't have hands, and carries it outside the nest and deposits it outside the nest. So it's kind of gross, but also really cute. And I have seen a video of someone who's taking care of a baby bird that was sadly abandoned. And this person has to take a pair of chopsticks and pick up the little poop package every time this bird feeds and then like presents its butt, presents this poop. It's really cute and also obviously a little gross.
Isn't that phenomenal that works that way? I actually challenge kids and adults sometimes, because we're all just big kids, to watch a nest with binoculars, and you can actually tell when the young have hatched and started to digest food or consume food, because you'll start to see the mother and dad too carrying away the fecal sac. It's just crazy.
Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, other animals I guess have to deal with quote unquote poopy diapers, except it's like a natural diaper.
Yeah. And it would be great if, you know, we had natural diapers for our young as well. But we don't. So
no, we don't. We don't. So another major theme in your book is the immune system, which, I mean, again, I, as an adult, got a kick out of reading this book, but it is a great book for kids as well. And I think this is a great introduction to the immune system to kids, because it seems overwhelming, right? Like the immune system, it's so complicated. There's so many things. But I think it's also like when you think about the parts of the immune system, it gets a little bit easier to understand what's going on, because there's actually two major parts of the immune system, and one is the innate or nonspecific immune system and the adaptive immune system. And the innate immune system we see every day when you look in the mirror, you look at other people. It's our skin, it's our mucus, it's our earwax, our hair, all of these things that are a barrier to pathogens. There's also on the cellular level innate immune cells such as phagocytes that will actually basically eat pathogens, eat things that are not supposed to be there, break them down so that they are harmless. Sometimes they break it down, and then that's when the adaptive immune system can come into play. So the adaptive immune system is the part of the immune system that actually launches a response specifically towards a type of pathogen that it recognizes. So when you learn about a virus, like you get infected with a virus, your body learns about it, then it launches an adaptive immune response. And this one is a little more precise, and it can be stronger. It can result in a stronger reaction. But it is it's really interesting, because this adaptive immune system is in this kind of like ballet with viruses and bacteria, this evolutionary kind of arms race. And so both humans and animals have adaptive and innate immune systems, and the balances can be different. Some animals actually have a very weak adaptive immune system or a very weak innate immune system, and it kind of, they balance each other out, like the deep sea anglerfish has actually kind of done away with a lot of its adaptive immune system, because the male deep sea anglerfish attaches itself to the female and actually kind of like fuses, grafts itself onto the female. And if this adaptive immune system knew that this male was there, it would try to kill it. And that would put a kibosh on the whole like mating strategy of these fish. And so instead, it's thought that it overcomes this weaker adaptive immune system with a stronger passive immune system, like a, you know, thicker skin, more mucosal membranes. And so, and also just the fact that they're not really running into each other a lot down there. It's so sparsely populated. But in general, animals have both an innate and an adaptive immune system. And the innate immune system can be really, really interesting. And I really love your examples in this book, especially when we're talking about slime. So what is, so many animals are slimy, and it seems gross, but it's actually really interesting and really important. So what is slime? What is mucus? And what is it used for? And why is it so popular in nature?
Oh, slime is awesome. Don't we love it? I mean, it is just great. We all have it. It's there. It's a part of, well, I don't know an animal that it's not a part of, but the amazing thing is that slime protects us. You know, it's in our nose, and it's one of those, other than the skin, which is kind of the first barrier, right? But that slime is there to catch intruders as they come into the body and attack it. One of the stories I love is about the hagfish, which people probably...
Yes, probably, I love the hagfish.
Oh, they're so gross and so slimy, right? and their slime does a number of different things, but it also includes lysozymes. The lysozymes are just these amazing attackers, right? So any bacteria or things like that, they just go at it, hack it, whack it, and smack it. And I just think that's pretty awesome to look at kind of across the animal kingdom, how similar adaptations are used, and also how every species has its own unique way of attacking these invaders. One of the stories I love to talk about is the ants, because ants don't get a lot of credit, right? I mean, there's little things, but amazingly, scientists are studying ants in order to better understand our immune system. One of the things that happens, at least in my mind, when I'm understanding immune systems, is it's so complex, it's hard to visualize, right? But when you think about an ant colony as an individual, a super organism, you can kind of get a better sense of how a human body might work. For example, we've all seen, right? Like we've all seen an ant hill. We see ants go in, right? And if you think about that ant hill, if you touch it, you know, how they react. So thinking that that ant hill is kind of like our skin, the outside surface, like if we attack it, they're going to attack us. Just like if something breaks our skin barrier, our immune system's going to attack it. But then there are the normal places where things go into the anthill, like the openings, you know, the entranceways. But right there at the entranceways to that anthill are guards. And those guards are going to attack anything that tries to come in that is not the self, right? Just like our nose, that slime in our nose is going to do the same thing, right? And as you go deeper into the anthill, you have more and more protection. What was amazing to me is, as I researched for this book, I discovered, I never thought about the fact that ants are exposed to fungus all the time because they live in the soil and fungus lives in the soil. And fungus would just love to like dive into an anthill and create an epidemic. Because one little ant carrying fungus spores into the anthill, oh, they could go crazy. But, you know, you've got those guards on the doorway that are going to maybe catch those spores. But as the ant worker ant goes deeper into the anthill, there are other cleaner ants, sanitation ants, right? And so what's fascinating to me is that these ants, these sanitation ants, remove these fungal spores, but yet don't get sick themselves. And I was like, how? And so I looked into the research, and it's just amazing. This guy, Christopher Pull, is doing some awesome research with them. One of the things that happens in certain ants is they actually put the spores in their mouths. Cleaning the ants, they're putting the spores in their mouth, which sounds really, really like the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, dangerous.
Yeah, right. But they have these pockets in their mouth, little pockets in their mouths that they stuff the spores into. And then they carry the spores off into the garbage, basically, and get rid of them.
And spit it out, yeah. That's amazing.
And the story goes deeper and deeper because in this story, actually, if the young, the pupa, the larva, are infected by spores, these sanitation ants actually destroy them, which sounds terrible, right?
It's zombie apocalypse rules, you know?
Totally the zombie apocalypse, right? But it's such an analogy to our own bodies, where if we have cells that are infected, guess what? They have to die.
Apoptosis is, it's really interesting because the cell death sounds really bad. Oh, cell death. It's the thing that keeps us alive. We need our cells to die. They can replenish. Obviously, if you have too much cellular death, that's a bad thing. But if you have no cellular death, that's actually what cancer basically is. It's when your cell doesn't know how to die. Your cell loses the ability. There's a mutation that prevents it from dying from this process called apoptosis. And that is really, really bad. It's also what protects us from pathogens because an infected cell can be like, uh-oh, this isn't good, actually like destroy itself. And even through destroying itself can cause the virus to break apart. And then that can be picked up by other cells, which go, oh, this is an interesting thing to learn from and bring those little antigens, the parts of the virus that can be learned from. And so, yeah, it's really interesting how like the immune system does attack our own body sometimes. And that's both important and life-saving and can also cause a lot of problems, right? Like if our immune system attacks our own cells too strongly, that can actually kill us. And if they don't attack cells strongly enough, it's too weak of an immune response. And so then the virus can actually directly harm our cells and go and replicate unabated. But yeah, that balance, I love the connection to the ants because you see these kind of very complex colony behaviors. is very much like how the immune system works, because with ants, you have a hierarchy, it's eusociality, right? Like, so you have very specific roles that each of the ants has. And you have, like, obviously the queen ants, which are the ones that are the only ones that can reproduce generally. But you also have different roles for the ants. And something, it can also be a different role based on the time in the ant's life. Or the same thing with bees, right? Like a bee's life cycle, their role might change as it gets older. And so you see a very similar thing in the immune system, where you have these immune cells and they have these, it's kind of like a eusocial system within our own bodies, because you have this hierarchical system, you have these very specific roles that each of the cells play and these rules they have to play by. And it's really interesting because we have to be a unified organism. There has to be that sacrifice in order to help the larger system, right? The entire ant colony or the entire human to function. And without that kind of sacrifice of these cells, we couldn't function as an entire organism, which I think is so interesting.
Yeah, right. And the fact, one of the other things that I found interesting about this story about the ants is that the worker ants basically are inoculating themselves against the disease.
Interesting.
Yeah. So if they're exposed to a small amount of spores, which they do, as, you know, workers bring in spores from the environment, then those sanitation ants are immune.
They develop immunity. That's incredible.
Yeah. Again, it's just a great analogy because we can visualize that ant moving here and there and everywhere. And in fact, in our body and all animals, you know, the cells are kind of like those little ants. Mm-hmm.
Mother's Day is coming, and mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can I go back to something you mentioned?
Absolutely.
And that is, you mentioned how our immune system sometimes kind of can react and overreact, and yeah, how that affects our body. You know, speaking specifically about viruses, because that's something that we're all very interested in these days.
Yeah.
You know, the symptoms really are just our body reacting and overreacting. And that mm-hmm. reminds me of the story of the bats, which just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. I love bats, and I love their... Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but I they're so interesting to me, and especially when it comes to immunity, because they have such big requirements in terms of energy for flying. A mammal that can fly, it's an incredible feat. It's this warm-blooded, thermoregulating animal that can also fly and has a relatively short evolutionary history of flight when you compare it to, say, like, insects. And so it's really, really interesting. And the pressures, the metabolic and energy pressures on these bats are incredible. And so they have really interesting immune systems. And anyways, now I'm going to let you tell your story.
No, that's great. I love it, because one of the things about bats is there's still so many questions about them, right? Like this idea that they can fly, but yet to do that requires this huge metabolic rate. How do they survive that? Because if we tried to do that, our body would crash in so many ways.
Yeah.
Number one, because we'd be producing so much waste that our immune system would be going after that waste, and it would be a storm of our immune yeah. system, right? So scientists are really curious about how bats actually survive. I mean, most people have heard that, you know, bats can carry many, many viruses, and that we can, in fact, acquire viruses from bats and vice versa. But, you know, how is that? How can they survive? I mean, there's so many bat species. There's bats across the entire world, except for Antarctica. And how can they be surviving so many viruses? And come to find out, one of the things is their innate immune system is strong, so strong that may be driving the evolution of viruses, right? Because right. their bodies, in order for a virus to successfully infect a bat, it's got to be pretty amazing. The yeah. interesting story that I discovered as I was doing research for this book is that the innate immune system, the first immune system basically, is so strong, the secondary or the adaptive or acquired, depending on who you're talking to, that immune system basically says, guess what, virus? If you made it past that first line, okay, so what? If the immune system decides to not react, and I'm saying this anthropomorphically, obviously, but right. if the immune system isn't reacting in this storm, the symptoms aren't there.
Right.
And in order to figure that out, the work that went into that was amazing, because you had to actually look at what was happening on a cellular level to create that storm, like this inflammation. They call it the inflammasome. And basically what's happening is, in comparison to other mammals, bats turn down like a dial. They turn down or they dial down that inflammation rate. And when you do that, you don't have the inflammation. When you don't have the inflammation, therefore, you don't have the symptoms. Basically, they're kind of saying, oh, wait, you're not really hurting me, virus. Why don't I just let you be? Like, we don't have to fight, which I think is a really cool message just to think about, right? If you're not really killing me, yeah, you know, we can deal. We can survive.
Yeah.
We can coexist, which is powerful.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, you do talk about this a bit in Sick, which again, I love, because this is so cool to like introduce these concepts of like the fact that we do have some viral DNA still with us, right? Like viruses don't always viruses and bacteria, especially, like, are not always dangerous. They can actually start to incorporate themselves. There's like there can be like a mutualistic symbiosis between animals and bacteria and even viruses. And it's so cool. And I mean, the other thing with bats is, like, I think it's a really important thing for people to understand that the reason that bats can have these viruses that can be dangerous for humans is not because they're dirty. They're actually very hygienic. But the fact that they have this very different kind of immune system, this immune system that has adapted differently from ours. So, like, when they encounter a virus, right, and they don't have, they have successfully whittled down the viral load because of their incredible innate immune system. And then they don't have as strong of an inflammatory response. So then they survive. When we're introduced to that same virus, our innate response, our adaptive response is going to be much stronger. And so we can actually, even though without our adaptive immune system, we wouldn't get very far because we wouldn't be able to destroy viruses and pathogens that could replicate inside of us. It also means that we can have this massive inflammatory response, a cytokine storm, which is essentially like a game of dominoes gone wrong inside of your immune system. And it can be really damaging. So it's like the same immune response that can save your life, right? Like a fever, which is killing off a bacteria or a virus, which can save your life, can also kill you. But back to the concept of these viruses not always being bad for us, like the fact that we have, like, in our DNA now, like, from, you know, millions of years ago, like, viral DNA that has inserted itself into our DNA and then it just works out is incredible to me.
Yeah, we think of that, you know, we have this bias that viruses are bad. Well, guess what? So much of our DNA is viral, which I had no idea how that happened, right? I didn't understand the entire concept of retroviruses, which, okay, can we dive deeply into this. I didn't get
to, let's do it.
There's an entire chapter that didn't make it into this book because it was so complex, but I just am so fascinated by it, right? So retroviruses, all viruses, most of us know that the virus has to enter the cell of the host to be replicated, right? But retroviruses go deeper than that. So once they enter the cell and their DNA is, their genetic material, I should say, is replicated, then that genetic material actually enters the cell's nucleus. Which is like, whoa, like, that's the safe house, you know, like, the cell is one thing, but entering the nucleus where, like, the genetic material of the host exists, you're like entering the vault. And then that retroviral genetic material inserts itself into the host's genetic material, which is, like, so mind-blowing that can actually happen. But if you think about it again, it's this concept that, like, do we have to be at war? There are two organisms here, and you can either be at war and one can win and the other can lose, or you could coexist. In an amazing way that's happened. And every placental mammal, mostly we think of that as, you know, us and other large organisms, but we all have retroviral DNA in us that allows us to give live birth.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Amazing. Okay, I have to tell you this story about these kittens that came into my life as I was doing this research. There was a cat that got hit by a car, and long story short, she was pregnant, and she was not going to make it. But she was doing well enough that she crawled up in my lap and gave birth to kittens.
Wow.
They were amazing. Well, I had never observed that. And I had been doing this research about placenta. So I got very interested in the placenta and how this happened. Turns out, you know, an a zygote, an embryo, is going to be considered non-self, right?
Right, yes.
An outside invader inside the mother. The question comes, how in the world does a mother's body accept this invader in? Because they shouldn't. Like, the immune system from the mother should attack this invader and kick it out. Well, who's really good at tricking the immune system? Viruses. In order for a virus to enter our cell, it has to trick us. It has to have that message on its surface, that protein that says, wait, wait, I'm part of you. It's okay. Don't worry about me. I belong here.
The fake ID that cells carry around. Because we have essentially tiny cops inside of our bodies called natural killer cells that will go around checking everyone's passport, checking everyone's papers. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little authoritarian inside our bodies sometimes. And so a lot of viruses have created this, like, basically a fake ID to show the natural killer cell, like, I'm legit. But yeah, that can be applied to protecting our own offspring. It's amazing.
Right. So if that future offspring didn't have that retroviral genetic material that therefore programmed the proteins on its surface to tell the mother, hey, it's okay, let me in, the placenta would never happen, right? The attachment would never happen. And so every single one of us, we should be thanking the viruses, right? Because we were born. It's just amazing. And a phenomenal thing, another aside, but it's amazing, is there are some lizards that do this as well. Wait, lizards? Lizards are not supposed to have placentas, but yet they do.
Yeah, some of them do.
Right? It's because this retroviral invasion has happened so many times across time. Gosh.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, it's the same. I think that people are more familiar with this concept when it comes to bacteria, right? Like, we've got good bacteria and bad bacteria. And a lot of it is not even just good or bad bacteria, but the balance of bacteria, right? Like, it's a specific balance of which bacteria you have. And your own immune system, right? For some people, bacteria that's generally good and fine can be bad for someone else because their immune system reacts too strongly to it. So there are all these different factors that come into play. But that's the same thing with, like, viruses, right? Like, it's true that most times you catch some kind of virus, right? Like a cold or a flu, it's not good for you. It's not necessarily good to get sick. You know, sometimes it's just a fact of life that you're going to get sick. And sometimes the timing of when you get sick can be really important, right? Like, if you get certain viruses, you absolutely do not want to get as an infant because your immune system's too weak. But some, if you do get as an infant, they're less serious when you're an adult. Now, we have vaccines, which make it a lot safer to introduce viral information to infants and to adults without us having to go through the risks of infection. But it's really interesting to see the way that, you know, that viruses, like being introduced to a virus isn't always bad. Sometimes it depends on the timing of the virus. And then sometimes there can be a virus that actually aids in our evolution. But then again, I'm not suggesting that you go out and, like, French kiss someone who has COVID or the flu, because most times that we encounter viruses, it's not necessarily going to be a good thing. It might not hurt us that badly, but it's certainly not going to, you know, be the next stage in human evolution. But if that happens enough, like, I think just the scale of evolution of millions of years of this happening, you know, once in a while, there will actually be a useful mutation caused by this viral DNA, which, again, it's really interesting when, like, that RNA and DNA essentially can, like, float around and then just be absorbed into the cell. And then, whoop, now it's part of our DNA. It's so weird. That doesn't seem like that should be how it works, right? That there can be free floating you know, RNA or DNA that we can actually incorporate into our own genome and then pass on through our reproductive cells. That seems like that should not work, but it does. And that's probably, I mean, that's like we're getting into sort of the origin of life, right? Like where you have these free floating strands of proteins that one, you know, glob absorbs another glob, and now it's become a more complex glob that has proteins that can start to actually construct new proteins, which is, you know, so hard for me to wrap my head around how that started, but
and so hard for all of us. And I think science in general, we're hesitant to accept ideas, which is awesome, right? That's what makes science unique, in that we consider new hypotheses and theories, but we have to have lots of evidence. And one of the really cool stories about that, of course, is our own mitochondria. This story started a very long time ago, where people started wondering, wait, what's up with this mitochondria? The powerhouse, right? The cells. Like our cells couldn't function without them because they're what convert the sugar into energy. But they're weirdos. They don't seem to belong in a cell. And for the long time, some scientists were very curious about this and saying, wait, there's something different. And other folks were like, no. What are you talking about? That's weird. You know, and for a long time, the science behind mitochondria, where they came from, was ignored. But now we understand that they're very different, the mitochondria as an organelle. And, you know, the theory is that they came from microbes. So if we had never incorporated this microbe, this other, you know, into a cell, the complex cells with the eukaryotes would never have evolved, which just is so mind-blowing.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I mean, the whole idea of good versus bad is a thing, you know, right? Like the story of the turkey vultures. We talk about vultures because they are awesome.
I mean, I love them. So yes, absolutely.
They're amazing. I mean, like they stick their head in the grossest, nastiest stuff, which we know is full of bacteria. And if we think about sticking our head into a dead body and eating it, of course we think everything in there, all that bacteria that's rotting it, it's got to be awful. But yet they don't get sick, right? Mm-hmm. They don't. They survive this stuff, and they don't have any food poisoning. And why? And so a scientist decided to investigate that. Like, he's like, we've got to understand what's going into their body. And so he took a bunch of dead vultures. Sadly, there were a number of vultures that he swabbed their faces and their necks and their. He found like over 700 different bacterial species on them. Like, wait, yeah. 700. Can you imagine? And some of those were like really, really intense. And he's like, okay, so what's going in their mouths, you know, is whatever's on their face. And lo and behold, when he looks in their guts, there's about 70, over just over 70 species. Like, that's huge. And so how did that happen? You know, and what's going on there? We don't know, right? That is such new science. We don't know. But what's intriguing to think about is the ones that are in the guts are the ones that we would freak out if they were in our guts. Like, there's flesh-eating bacteria in there. There's E. coli. There's the stuff we're like, whoa, get away from us, right? But yet, they're surviving and thriving in there. And we would assume that that's terrible, but maybe not. You know, maybe they're actually supporting each other.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is what is so interesting, right? Like, you can have these very complex symbiotic relationships. And symbiosis is not always good and it's not always bad, right? Like, symbiosis just describes a close, basically a ballet between two species. It could be a parasite and a host, or it could be a mutualistic relationship. And sometimes these relationships can like change over time, right? Something that was once like maybe at some point in the vulture's evolutionary history, these bacteria did harm them. And then over time, they evolved to coexist in a way where the bacteria were able to survive, but so was the vulture. And I mean, it's so interesting because, I mean, I love vultures, and I love how like all of the things that we see about them that seems to make them gross, right? Like, they have these bald heads and it's like, oh, that's gross looking. That's for hygiene. That's so blood and stuff doesn't get stuck to their feathers. And then they poop on themselves. They poop on their legs. And for us, that'd be like the most gross thing you could do. But that's also for hygiene. They have this very like bird poop in general is a combination of urine and feces typically. And so like the vulture poop has this very, it's very acidic. And so it actually cleans their legs. And so it's like these things that we would consider disgusting about them, right? Like they're eating a corpse. It's usually a rotting cadaver, or it's really disgusting. Well, they're actually taking a lot of like bacteria and nasty things out of the environment, and then converting it into food, containing it, and expelling it in a way that is less harmful to other animals, to the environment. So it's like, you know, these are actually amazing, like. We can think of them as like the sanitation experts of the animal kingdom. So everything that seems gross about them to us is actually this process of taking these bad things and then turning it into a process that like works for them and then is helpful for preventing the spread of disease in other animals.
We should be thanking them every day.
I personally do.
I realize I misspoke when Gary, the scientist, Gary Graves, studied the vultures. He found over 500 species on their heads.
Wow.
Oh my gosh. Like, it's so many. But, you know, what we keep kind of coming back to is this idea of evolution and, you know, microbes and germs and all of those things that we see as so bad. They're bad for individuals.
Yes.
But for populations, it's different, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to, you know, our perspective as individuals is that these things are bad because they can kill individuals. But if we look in the evolutionary scope, that's different, right? In terms of the diversity that we have on the planet, they've driven this evolution. And that's just a mind-boggling idea.
Right. Yeah. And without that diversity, I mean, what's interesting, right, is because we have all sorts of different selective pressures from the very small, like bacteria and viruses, to the very large, like a meteor hitting the Earth and changing the climate. And we can't, like the fact that like bacteria and viruses have driven this diversification of species, right? Like, you know, you would think like, well, so what, right? It causes a lot of suffering. So it's not, they're not really good to have. But because you have such a diversity of species, then life can survive things like the climate suddenly changing, a meteor striking the earth and causing, because now you have more of a like a genetic library for these different animals. And so you're going to have mass extinction of a lot of animals, but you're going to have just enough that have the ability to survive this. And so much of that is driven by microbes, by things that are harmful and bad, but have driven this diversification of species that they actually are able to survive, you know, devastating events. Maybe not on the individual level, which is sad for the individual, of course, but in terms of like just life on Earth, like viruses and bacteria are not necessarily bad for life on Earth. Like for individual lives, yes. And so again, keep washing your hands, keep getting vaccinated. I'm not saying on an individual level it's good for us to get walloped by the flu or whatever, but yeah, in terms of just general life on Earth, these relationships that we have with pathogens is actually really complex, and it's not all bad.
Exactly. And there's the whole idea that we've lumped all microbes into this bad category. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very easy for us to do because we can't see them. And when we can't see them, we don't understand them. And that's why I'm so passionate about learning and teaching about this, because the more we know, wow, it opens our eyes to so many things that we didn't understand. This complexity that's there, these microbes that are in our bodies that we wouldn't survive without, you know, that's just, it's mind blowing.
It's something you can't, even if you can't directly see it, it's something you can feel. If you've ever had a bad stomach flu, which I have had recently, and essentially what happens with a stomach flu is your body is like hits the eject button because something is in there that's bad. Sometimes it's a virus, sometimes it's food poisoning. And so your body is like, emergency, we've got to evacuate. We've got to get rid of this. So you're going to vomit and you're going to have diarrhea. And so that's why it's, I mean, the number one thing when you have a stomach flu or food poisoning is hydration, because like you're losing a lot of fluid. Food, you don't have to worry about as much. You will be hungry when you're hungry. It's going to take a little while, but yeah, so you should hydrate, but your body is doing something important. It is getting rid of something that it thinks is really dangerous and could really severely hurt you. Is it always right? Maybe not, but it's doing the best job it can in terms of gauging, okay, when do we need to just eject everything? But what happens is you actually lose, like through that ejection, like after that, you might find that sometimes you get more kind of, you feel kind of yucky a while after, like after you're done with the stomach flu, after you're done with the food poisoning, you still kind of maybe get maybe some like indigestion or some stomach issues. And it's like, well, because you flushed out a lot of good bacteria as well. And which is why, you know, the immune response has to be so delicate and not always go off all the time whenever you are infected with the, you know, a tiny pathogen, like because that flushing out, you are flushing out also like good bacteria. So it's, you know, it's good to like try to, you know, once you start to rehydrate and eat food and stuff, and naturally your gut flora will repopulate. So it's not something you have to panic about or anything like that, but it is really interesting. And it's so interesting, these there are things in medicine where we recognize, right, the power of this gut bacteria. So we have things like fecal transplants, which sounds horrifying, not like something that you would want to have happen, but it is apparently something that can be really important in terms of helping repopulate someone's gut with good bacteria, with something that can actually help them, help a person. Like when you digest food, it can also protect you from other bacteria, because bacteria, like any organism, are in competition with each other. So if you have a less harmful bacteria that is populating your gut, it will try to compete with and interfere with bacteria that might make you sick. So yeah, like bacteria is often our friend. It's just sometimes when it isn't, it's really noticeable.
Yeah, and it's nasty, disgusting. Yeah, fecal transplants are just amazing. I can hardly believe that that works, but it does. And once I met some folks who have had fecal transplants and successfully, you know, cured, it's just amazing what they can do. So one of the things that amazes me is that even bacteria that we see as the bad guys, like Staphylococcus, right, which can be really a huge problem, but staph itself is infected. Some staph can exist on us in a very healthy way, and other staph that has genetic material that's, we're not really sure how it gets in there, but it has additional genetic material from another organism that, in fact, is like it itself is infected. So we don't think about the fact that all of these microbes are in their own world dealing with infections of themselves. Yeah. Just mind-blowing.
When you zoom out more, like, it's easier to comprehend that, where when you have a mosquito, mosquitoes do not make us sick, right? Mosquitoes are would actually be relatively harmless. They are parasites, but they would, if not for pathogens that actually infect the mosquitoes themselves would be pretty harmless to like a human. But because they themselves can be infected with pathogens, with like something that can actually be passed on to us, and in fact that is the whole reason that they will infect the mosquito. The mosquito can then pass something along to us. And so something that we see, right, like as this mosquito is like hurting us, it's like, well, it's not really the mosquito itself. It's whatever has hitched a ride on the mosquito. And then, but then when you, of course, like you go and sort of like all the evolutionary pressures and the sorts of like symbiotic relationships that affect like organisms, you know, macroorganisms, are those same things are happening on a microscopic level. Like, I don't talk about it as much because it is not sort of my area of expertise, but it is still really, really interesting.
It is mind-blowing. I came across a study of ticks, same concept, where a tick doesn't ask to be infected by Lyme disease, right? That's not something they chose, yeah. Right? They are infected. There's an amazing study of a lizard out in the Western United States who, if an infected tick bites this lizard, we don't understand everything that's going on here, but the tick, when it leaves the lizard, no longer has Lyme disease, carries Lyme disease.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So amazing, right? So something's happening when the blood from the lizard enters the foregut of the tick that's affecting that disease-causing microbe. Just mind-blowing to think about. You know, we think of ticks, oh, they're terrible, awful, but just like mosquitoes, they in and of themselves don't cause that much damage. But
yeah, but they are too convenient of a little taxi for like they, like mosquitoes, ticks, fleas, rats, you know, all these little animals that we think of as, you know, gross, like, you know, plague bearing animals. It's just because they're little taxis, right? Like they get around a lot. They're easy to hitch a ride on. And, you know, I mean, it's like a flea hitching a ride on a rat, but then, you know, the bubonic plague hitching a ride on the flea. It's these other intermediary organisms have no idea that they are little cab drivers for disease, and it's not really their fault. It's not even the disease's fault when you get down to it. But, you know, it's just, it is really interesting. Before we go, I guess I just wanted to circle back to kind of the initial question that we talked about. Like, why do you think so-called gross stuff is so fascinating to people, right? Because I certainly find it fascinating. I have never grown out of finding poop and puke and mucus to be really interesting. Now, I don't want to necessarily see it much in real life, right? Like if I step on dog poop, I'm not like, well, this is great. But in terms of being interested in stories about it, being interested in the science of it, what do you think is so compelling about it that kids and adults, even adults who don't want to admit it, find so interesting?
I think it's the questions. Because I think questions are, or curiosity, all to link together, that's what drives learning. And the human mind wants to learn, right? We're innately driven to learn and learn and learn. And when we find something such as poop or blood or something like that, that society says, oh no, gross, don't look at that, don't pay attention to it. We're like, wait, what? You know, I want to know more. And the first question is, why? Why am I not supposed to look at that, right? It's a kind of a taboo subject, but why? And then that just drives us to learn more and more. The human mind, it's an amazing thing. When we ask those questions, when we look a little closer, that's when we discover all of this that we've been talking about today was all driven by questions. Somebody's question about something weird that happened that they observed, and they dug a little deeper. And in the end, our minds get blown again and again as we look at the animal kingdom, right? As we discover these little bits and pieces. And what I'm so fascinated with is the fact that every single one of us can do that every day. All we have to do is look and start asking questions.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find your book? What's it called? And because I think that it's a really fun book. I think it's especially good for older kids. But look, I read it. I'm an adult and I still enjoyed it. So where can people get your book?
Well, first, thanks for that. I'm honored that you read it and enjoyed it so much. This book is called Sick, The Twists and Turns Behind Animal Germs. And you can find it online bookstores. It will not be available until February 20th. And it's also available if you want to look at any of my books at heatherlmontgomery.com.
Yeah. And can you pre-order it or is it?
Yes, it can be pre-ordered any online bookseller.
Fantastic. I have so much respect for these kinds of books and science education because I think it's so important to help drive sort of what kids are interested in. And if kids are interested in gross stuff and it's like, well, maybe we should pay attention to that and respect that rather than, you know, seeing that as not an appropriate thing. So thank you so much again for coming on today. And thank you to the listeners for listening to the show. A happy new year, everyone. I'm so excited about a whole new year of podcasting. If you are enjoying the show and you leave a rating or review, I deeply appreciate it. I read all of your reviews, every single one. Print them all out, make a book, read it every night to myself. And thank you to the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exolumina. Creature Feature is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or hey, guess what? Wherever you listen to your favorite shows, I am not your mother. I cannot tell you what to do, how you decide to live your life. I will see you next Wednesday.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.